The unchanging nature of the underground made time hard to judge as the team followed Varnley through the gloom.
I don't get this at all. Where are those goddamn plasma bees coming from? Is it the same swarm that chased us in New Mexico?
I don't see how. They must reproduce in some way. I have to agree with Spiros Marcuse's theory that they're a combination of radiations and plasma waveforms held together by a magnetic field.
How much further are we going?
Not far. Look, there is the freight elevator.
Varnley led them to the massive doors and tapped in a code on the keypad on the wall. The five people moved inside, and Varnley selected a floor.
Marcuse's theory wouldn't account for the apparent intelligence displayed by the Viral.
Or why they're green.
The elevator shot upward at breathtaking speed, making Kane's stomach feel as if it were sinking into the soles of his boots. Varnley seemed unaffected, cocking his head at a puzzled angle.
I don't understand.
What's to understand? The Viral is green.
They are all different colors.
They only look green to us.
My eyes see in a far broader range of the spectrum than yours.
That may mean something.
Like what?
If the Viral is composed of radiation, then Breach might have a method of controlling it using high-frequency radiation in the radio wave spectrum.
So we may be using them as a pack of hunting dogs.
Or they may be intelligent, but their intelligence might be a different order than what we human beings understand.
Kane repressed the urge to smile at Varnley's inclusion of himself as a human. Eyeing the hybrid surreptitiously, he again wondered just how many truly human people populated Earth, but there was no way to hazard an accurate guess. Even the intelligence-gathering apparatus of the magistrate divisions and the Vills could not learn with any certainty about what was transpiring beyond the continental boundaries of the country. Radio waves would not reach across the sea because lingering radiation and atmospheric disturbances disrupted shortwave carrier bands. After two centuries, the aftereffects of the new cost and the sky dark were more subtle, an underlying texture to a world struggling to heal itself. But the side effects of the war still let themselves be known from time to time, like a grim reminder to humanity to never take the permanence of the planet for granted again. One of the worst and most frequent side effects had been chemstorms, showers of acid-tainted rain that could scorch the flesh off any mammal caught in the open. They were lingering examples of the freakish weather effects common after the nuke cost. Chemstorms were dangerous partly because of their intensity, but mainly because of the acids, heavy metals, and other chemical compounds that fell, with the rain possessing the corrosive potency to strip flesh from bone in less than a minute. Fortunately, chemstorms were no longer as frequent as they had been even a century before, but there were still a number of places where the geological or meteorological effects of the nuke cost prevented a full recovery. These regions were called hell zones, areas that not even the passage of time could cleanse of hideous, invisible plagues. The cargo elevator jolted to a stop, and the doors opened up on a huge, dark space. Varnley led them into a multi-leveled man-made cavern so vast its true dimensions could not really be gauged. The far end ran away into the murk, and the ceiling was lost in the shadows. Large rectangular containers were arranged in orderly 50-foot-tall aisles, stretching as far as they could see. The containers were made of lightweight corrugated metal with hinged lids. Smooth ramps sloped between the levels and were wide enough to permit forklifts and motorized dollies to carry their loads. At regularly spaced intervals were wide square apertures leading out of the huge chamber. Gleaming monorail tracks laced out in every direction, plunging into the apertures. On one track stood a small shifter engine with a chrome nose coupled to a flat car holding three metal crates. Kane walked over to it and glanced up and down the narrow track.
Which way?
Varnley nodded in the direction the nose of the engine was pointed.
There.
But there's no passenger car.
You're not so special that you can't ride on the flat car. You haven't been Twee-Twee-John the Imperial Mother in a long time.
Yeah, you'll make good ballast.
What?
I hear something.
Kane tilted his head first to one side, then the other.
I don't.
Notwithstanding.
As Kane stepped to the rear of the flat car, he put a foot on the metal rail. A steady vibration shivered through it. Then, from an opening in the wall 200 yards away, plunged a blunt-nosed shifter engine. He glimpsed three men wearing dun-colored coveralls seated within it. He didn't need to see the Coleco subguns in their hands to know they wielded them.
Move! Move!
Grant jumped into the flat car, his Sin Eater slapping into his palm. Erica and Varnley climbed into the compartment of the engine while Bridget and Kane joined Grant on the flat car, squeezing between the crates. As they did so, Varnley got their engine engaged, and with a slight lurch, the train slid along the rail. Bullets hit the floor around the rail, gouging scars. Another bullet punched a dimple in the side of a metal-walled crate.
Hang on!
All of them felt a shock of acceleration as the train plunged into the tunnels. Overhead light fixtures strobed as the monorail car sped under them. The car carrying the Millennialists came rocketing after them a few seconds later. The bores of the weapons in their hands spit tongues of flame. Little spouts of concrete sprang up the right side of the flat car. Bridget positioned herself to return the fire, squeezing off three rounds from her TP-9. The Calicos of the Millennialists continued to hammer, and bullets smacked into the flat car. Kane ducked instinctively.
Damn it!
He squeezed off a short tri-burst from his Sin Eater. The round struck sparks from the nose of the pursuing train. The track curved to the left, and Grant, Kane, and Bridget grabbed the edges of the flat car as the boxes went sliding. Gritting his teeth, Kane felt as if he were trapped in a recurrent nightmare where the same things happened over and over again, no matter what actions he took.
They're obviously willing to kill us, not just slow us down.
Pushing himself to one knee, Kane slightly turned his head toward Varnley.
How far is the Prometheus wing?
Not much further. Perhaps only 5 miles.
Only? We can't keep this shit up for 5 miles.
What do you suggest?
Reaching into his war bag, Grant pulled out a canister-shaped RG-34 high-explosive grenade.
This will stop the chase pretty conclusively.
Yeah, providing you time to throw just right.
A bullet struck the crate beside Grant and he ducked.
I think the time is pretty goddamn right.
Grant slipped the spoon, pulled the pin, then dropped the grenade. It bounced along the rail for several yards. The pursuing engine drove right straight into the bloom of flame and concussion. The car leaped from the rail, flipped, rolling end over end.
That, as they say, is that.
Kane rose up and turned around, looking over the heads of Erica and Varnley. As their train went around a curve, he stiffened.
Oh, hell.
Bridget and Grant looked in the direction he stared. The plasma swarm glowed in the center of the tunnel, exploding like silent skyrockets.
They're multiplying. They're going to trap us.
Maybe another grenade would work.
I don't think so. The explosion would get us too.
Do we take the chance of smashing through them, or stopping and surrendering?
Neither. Let's keep going.
Erica pushed herself up from the engine compartment seat.
Let me out. I'll take my chances.
Reaching over, Kane slammed her back into a sitting position.
We do this together. You wanted to come along, and now you're in it as deep as we are.
Kane glanced ahead again when he was certain Erica would stay put. He clenched his teeth as the engine arrowed straight for the cloud of green glowing orbs. The bullet-shaped engine plunged on like a missile. The swarm of orbs did not shift position.
I don't think we can bluff them, and slowing down won't do any good.
Varnley half rose, light glinting from the slender infrasound wand grasped in his right fist. The pulsing, shivering tip inscribed a blurry semicircle. The viral cloud suddenly quivered, then the orbs in the center of the swarm spun away, leaving a large gap. The monorail car plunged through the hole in the green glimmering cloud. Glancing behind him, Kane watched the swarm spiral first to the right, then to the left, but not reform into a cloud shape.
They don't appear to be coming after us.
The jolt of infrasound probably damaged them, maybe even destroyed a few.
Wouldn't that be nice?
The monorail carriage swerved around a curve in the tunnel, and the viral cloud was lost to view. The shifter engine and the flat car glided smoothly along the rail. Up ahead glowed the light of a train platform. Varnley adjusted the controls, and their speed slackened. When they came abreast of the platform, they saw the letters and numbers Y-95 stenciled on the wall above it. The train gradually slowed to a halt. Everyone disembarked, assembling on the platform. Erica shook her head, half in exasperation, half in relief.
I was very fast thinking, Varnley. I underestimated you.
Varnley's blank expression did not alter, but Kane received the distinct impression he was pleased with the praise. Grant gazed uneasily at the corridor stretching away from the station, not liking how it plunged into darkness.
We'd better get going before the bees regroup and come buzzing after us again.
The Cerberus warriors paused long enough to put on dark-lensed glasses. The electrochemical polymer of the lenses gathered all available light and made the most of it to give them a limited form of night vision. They strode swiftly along the corridor, alert for any unusual sound. The floor sloped upward at a gradual angle. Handrails lined both walls. The incline terminated at a flat landing. A few yards away stood the wire-shielded double doors they had seen earlier on the monitor screen. The skin on the back of Kane's neck tightened as his point man sense pricked him. No one seemed willing to move.
The Prometheus wing, I presume?
I don't see any millennialists or virals.
Me either. But that doesn't mean they're not around.
Something's not right. This feels far too convenient.
Yes. So we might as well take advantage of it before everything becomes very inconvenient.
The black-haired woman took a tentative step forward, then another. Irritated that he couldn't contain his mag-trained impulse to take point, even to let the manipulating bitch go first, Kane stepped in front of her, his sin-eater held in a double-handed grip, barrel pointing upward. Bridget and Grant automatically took up positions on either side of him, weapons at the ready. Kane paused at the pair of doors, listening.
Well, that sounds familiar. Damn it.
Kane nodded to Grant and Bridget, then pushed open the right-hand door with the toe of his boot. It swung aside easily. Slowly, he eased over the threshold, pausing for his eyes to become adjusted to the deep gloom. It was much darker than in the corridor. He saw a chamber hung with large-scale maps of the United States and Europe. They were dimly illuminated from beneath. He quickly picked out red concentric circles emblazoned over various countries. Bridget entered and came to his side. She glanced at the maps.
First strike targets.
I figured.
One by one, the group of five slipped through the door. They walked across the chamber toward another set of doors on the far side. As their vision accustomed to the murk, they could see rising all around them a complex array of machine relays, connectives, and many pieces of electronic equipment.
What's all that stuff for?
I don't know. It's such a hodgepodge.
Shh! Opening the next set of doors.
The other door opened just as easily as the first, but the light was much stronger. Kane pushed it open with a shoulder. He and his companions emerged on a broad shelf that thrust out over a cavernous gallery nearly 20 feet below. They stood at a metal handrail, staring down at the fusion generator. 12 feet tall, it resembled two solid black cubes, a slightly smaller one placed atop the larger. The top cube rotated slowly, producing the drone. The odor of ozone was very pronounced.
Is anybody surprised to see that?
Grant and Bridget looked resigned, Erica thoughtful, and Varnley impassive. The Cerberus warriors had seen identical machines in several places across the world over the past 5-plus years. The two-tiered generators derived from the same source as the light panels, the Anunnaki. Long ago, Lakesh had put forth the initial speculation they were fusion reactors, the energy output held in a delicately balanced magnetic matrix within the cubes. When the matrix was breached, an explosion of apocalyptic proportions resulted, which was what caused the destruction of the Archuleta Mesa installation.
Now we know there's Anunnaki tech being used. Partly, anyway.
Bridget frowned. She looked at the complexity and extent of the circuitry surrounding the generator. Lines ran across the floor and into the walls.
I've never seen a generator hooked up like that before. It seems to be only a component instead of a power source.
Suddenly, the uppermost cube of the generator stopped rotating.
Uh-oh.
Directly above the top cube of the generator, a spiral of green lights appeared, seeming to bleed into existence from thin air. The huge viral formation floated lazily in the gallery. While everyone watched, the shape changed from a spiral to a cloud, still floating lazily around the generator. Terror tightened a fist around Bridget's heart. While she watched, the cloud became a tight ball of dancing red light. Under other circumstances, Bridget Baptiste would have thought the prismatic changeover in color was beautiful, but the sight of it made her throat constrict.
Maybe we should back away.
As soon as he moved 1 foot back, crooked threads of red lightning erupted out of the viral cloud. They whiplashed around the people standing on the ledge, and for only an instant, Bridget glimpsed a skein of blood-hued electricity crawling over her face. Bridget came awake slowly. First, the black void turned to gray, then to a pale, shimmering red. Pain consumed her body. Her head pounded rhythmically, in cadence with her heartbeat. She tried to open her eyes, but she couldn't see anything but a dull, reddish blob, and she wondered if she had lost her sight. She tried to put her hands under her, but they seemed to be somewhere else, beyond her control. Her stumbling thoughts probed for the reason why. Grinding her teeth, Bridget mentally explored her body, noting its position and posture. She realized she lay on her back, and when she tried to move, cramping needles of agony shot up her shoulders and arms. A persistent pressure compressed her wrists, squeezing them so tightly together her hands were no more than numb, half-remembered presences at the ends of her arms. By a tentative exploration with her fingertips, she felt hard straps pinning her wrists. She turned her body, aware of the tremors that went through her. Nausea became a clawed animal trying to tear its way out of her stomach. It was all she could do to swallow the column of burning bile working its way up her throat. Bridget shifted her legs, and they trembled violently. She struggled frantically, managing to angle her elbows to lever herself up, but her body went into convulsions. She fell back, realizing her body was dissociated from the messages of her mind. Every order from her brain seemed to confuse her nerves and muscles. She tasted fear, a sharp, bitter tang as of freshly sheared copper wire. She opened her mouth to call for help, but shut it again. Although her thoughts moved like half-frozen mud, she knew it was best to keep as silent and as motionless as possible. She opened her eyes wide, blinking repeatedly. The wavering red glow slowly resolved itself into a distorted low-angle view of the two-tiered generator. A hazy crimson aura surrounded it. When Bridget realized she lay at its base, memory and awareness returned in a simultaneous rush. She strained at the binding around her wrists, but felt no slack. She guessed that the exposure to the energy of the viral had scrambled her nervous system. Pain thudded at the back of her head, and she lay there, trying to calm down.
That's right. Fighting it only makes the effects worse. You'll recover in a moment. Relax.
A hand inserted itself between the back of her neck and floor and lifted her to a sitting position. Bridget blinked repeatedly, and a man's dark face swam into focus. He wore a beige coverall, begrimed with oil, grease, and bloodstains.
You took an EMP jolt. Pretty mild, considering the size of the viral. That's why your eyes aren't working right. The eyes are particularly vulnerable to EM radiation.
You're Quintus Breach.
One and the same. I've seen pictures of you in the consortium files. You're Bridget Baptiste. You look just like your pics.
I can't say the same for you.
Bridget studied him. He did not resemble the dapper Quintus Breach she had seen on the DVD. His face showed raw abrasions, and two of his teeth were missing. He shrugged.
You can't tinker around with the power of the quantum field and not get kicked around a little.
Or die.
Breach smiled crookedly, seemingly unconcerned.
Yeah, there's that. But I'm prepared.
You are?
Sure. When my time comes, I'll accept it without complaint. There won't be any monuments erected over my grave. Well, I'll have made my contribution.
To what?
To the next step in humanity's evolution. That alone is a worthwhile epitaph.
Bridget eyed the man, looking for any signs of dementia. He seemed sane enough, and his stoic attitude toward death was one she understood. She had learned to accept risk as a part of her way of life, taking chances so that others might find the ground beneath their feet a little more secure. She didn't consider her attitude idealism, but simple pragmatism. If she had learned anything from her friends, it was to regard death as a part of the challenge of existence, a fact that every man and woman must face eventually. She could accept it without humiliating herself, if it came as a result of her efforts to remove the yokes of the barons from the collective neck of humanity. Although she never spoke of it, certainly not to the cynical Kane, she had privately vowed to make the future a better, cleaner place than either the past or the present.
Where are my friends?
Safe. That is, about as safe as they could be under the circumstances.
I don't like the sound of that.
Breach's smile disappeared. His eyes became haunted.
There's no reason why you should.
I suppose you and Erica had a lot to talk about.
She's here?
You didn't see her?
No. The viral incapacitated all of you. But when we came to collect you, I couldn't find her. At first, I thought she might have stayed behind.
You seem happy that she's here.
Why wouldn't I be? I love her.
Bridget stared at him, surprised into speechlessness for a long moment.
Your men tried to kill all of us, Erica included.
I know. Come now. Up you go.
Putting his hands under her arms, he heaved her to her feet, steadying her as her legs wobbled. Bridget attempted to take a step forward, but lost her balance and nearly fell. Breach caught her.
Can't you cut my hands loose, so I can at least catch myself if I fall?
If you were anyone else, I would. But you're no ordinary woman. Just aim yourself for that door.
Breach pointed to a bevel-framed doorway a few yards away. Carefully, as though she walked on a heaving deck, Bridget tottered toward the opening, with Breach's hand at her elbow. Her face was locked in a mask of concentration as she blocked out everything but the necessity to take the next step, and the next, and the next.
I'm sorry that a couple of my men got trigger-happy. My staff is fused out, and some are worse off than others. I've been forced to discipline them.
Bridget glanced at the abrasions on his face.
Looks like it's been a two-way street.
Breach forced a smile as he stabilized Bridget to keep her from toppling over backward.
It's been something of a study in behavioral neurology.
What's been?
How different people react to exposure to the EM field. I'm probably a little mad myself.
I don't doubt it.
You might still feel a little queasy, so if you need to throw up, just let me know.
I am feeling a little sick to my stomach. Why is that?
Radiation.
What kind of radiation?
I'm not sure. The wavelength is in the ultra-high frequency. Only very sensitive equipment can detect it, much less measure it.
You're talking theta-band emissions, aren't you?
Breach glanced at her in surprise.
I'm afraid so. You know about the transmitter?
As much as it's possible to know about Anunnaki technology.
I figured we were dealing with retro-engineered alien tech. I think there might be some Danann in it, too.
They stepped over the threshold into the adjoining room, and Bridget's gait faltered. The room was filled from floor to ceiling with an intricate mass of circuitry. Indicator lights glowed, switches fluttered steadily, and a multitude of little chevron-shaped panels pulsated.
As a general rule, the Twaha de Danann didn't use such extensive machinery.
Yeah, that's what Erica said, too.
So, what is all this gear?
Breach turned earnest eyes upon her.
I was hoping you could tell me.
I've never seen anything like this. Especially the red glow around the generators. You must have a theory about it.
Yes. At first, I assumed the generator was a power source. A self-perpetuating feed shunt from the quantum stream. Now I'm not sure. If you know about the Anunnaki...
He pressed his lips together in a thin line, jaw muscles bunching.
What?
If you know about the Anunnaki and the Archons... Maybe you can tell me if any of them are still alive in this machine.
I don't understand.
I don't either. Erica told me about the Archons and their genetic relationship with the Danann and the Anunnaki, but this device doesn't seem to be of their creation. But I've been told about the First Folk and how they used some kind of energy that almost destroyed the world. Protoplanic? Does that ring a bell?
A chill finger ran up and down Bridget's spine. The First Folk, the so-called Archons, had used the technology from both the Anunnaki and the Twaha de Danann, redesigning it and blending both into a single form with several functions. However, the Danann and Anunnaki forbade the sharing of advanced scientific knowledge with humanity. Lakesh had speculated the solution to both the riddle of the so-called Archons and humanity's mysterious origins lay in ancient religious codices. He had finally come to accept that he could not penetrate the convoluted conspiracy of secrecy that had been maintained for 20,000 years or more. The few surviving sacred texts contained only hints, inferences passed down from generation to generation, not actual answers. Ancient documents that might have held the truth had crumbled into dust or were deliberately destroyed. Regardless, historical records of non-human influence on Terran development ran uninterrupted from the very dawn of humankind to the present day. Always it was the same. Human beings as possessions, with a never-ending conflict bred between them, promoting spiritual decay and perpetuating conditions of unremitting physical hardship. And always, secret societies were created by human pawns to conceal and to protect the true nature of humanity's custodians, or masters. Such societies traced their roots back to ancient Egypt, Babylon, Mesopotamia, Greece, and Sumeria. Throughout humankind's history, secret covenants with mysterious non-human entities, known by a variety of names in a variety of places, the Nagas, the Oans, the Titans, and lastly, the Archons, were struck by kings, princes, and even presidents. The secret societies acted more or less as the plenipotentiaries of the entities, and their oaths revolved around a single theme: the presence of the beings must never be revealed to humanity at large. The first folk, the hybrid race propagated by the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann, functioned much like a secret society. It was their duty to keep the ancient secrets of their ancestors alive, yet not perpetuate the same errors as their forebears, especially in their dealings with humans, with whom they shared a genetic link. Humankind was still struggling to overcome a global cataclysm, striving again for civilization, and the graceful first folk did what they could to assist. They insinuated themselves into schools, into political circles, prompting and ensuring men made the right decisions. Due to the first folk's influence, humankind enjoyed 1,000 years of relative peace and harmony, during which the Atlantean civilization arose. Lam, a leader of the first folk and Balaam's father, sought to convince the Anunnaki and Danann representatives to allow humanity to grow and evolve without strictures. Instead, the two races threatened to visit another cataclysm upon Earth and hurl humankind back into savagery. The first folk knew their forebears had too many weapons in their arsenals, stolen and adapted from other worlds they visited and exploited, for them to be able to defend Earth. Nor did they possess the resources to fight an all-out war. But once they had aroused their forebears' suspicions, they had no choice but to take quick, preemptive action. They employed an energy they called protoplanic. According to what Bridget had been told, the Force demolished an Anunnaki settlement on the moon and killed the royal family. A blowback effect, a reverse reaction that the first folk had not foreseen, very nearly destroyed the Earth. It decimated human and the first folk civilizations. In their attempts to defend humankind, they had inadvertently brought about the destruction their forebears had threatened. After the global catastrophe, the first folk transformed themselves to adapt to the new environment. Their muscle tissue became less dense, motor reflexes sharpened, optic capacities broadened. A new range of psychic abilities were developed that allowed them to survive on a planet whose magnetic fields had changed, whose weather was drastically unpredictable. In the process, the physical appearance of the first folk changed from tall, slender, graceful creatures to small, furtive shadow dwellers. Although the survivors of the custodial race were viewed by humans as demons and monsters, they still tried to protect humanity over the long track of time as they clawed their way back up from barbarism. At the dawn of Earth's Industrial Revolution, the first folk's descendants, the entities later known as Greys and Archons, feared more reprisals from their forebears. As protective coloration, they fabricated a convoluted false history designed to confound any enterprising human who got too close to the truth.
Well, I need to know, is this protoplanic energy?
I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you, but I don't know. The circuitry in this room represents a science of an ordered systematic knowledge that is designed to control the forces of nature, if not the universe itself.
Bridget eyed the machines, her eyes troubled. The extent of the forces, how vast their effects, she had no way of even guessing, but she had the unsettling sensation that the machines channeled the same energies that had destroyed the world eons before.
Come this way.
Breach led the way down a spiral flight of metal stairs and entered a vault-walled chamber. The room was circular and much larger than had looked possible. A gleaming spire rose from the center of the floor, reaching like a spear through an aperture in the high ceiling. 4 huge metal rings surrounded its base, but as they ascended, they decreased in diameter. There were perhaps 50 of the rings visible. A dim glow came from the hole in the roof, illuminating the rings. A pale nimbus, a kind of wavering halo, shimmered from each ring.
It looks like a super collider.
Close. It's a large ion collider expediter, known in the old vernacular as Alice.
You put this together? You built this?
Oh no, Alice was already here.
He gestured to the base of the spire, and she saw hair-thin filaments stretching out from it, disappearing into sockets on the floor.
We just hooked up the power feeds.
Why?
Breach regarded her with hollow, haunted eyes.
I hoped, we could engineer a new beginning, a fresh start for humanity.
Bridget gritted her teeth against a pain stabbing through her skull.
By cobbling together old Archon tech that pre-dark scientists realized was too dangerous to use?
I didn't know it was Archon tech. Not exactly, anyway.
But you put it together nevertheless.
Oh, we had to. That was the plan. The transmitter itself was already assembled. It just needed to be connected to the generator. We did that.
And now?
And now we can't turn it off. It's drawing power from somewhere, and I have the feeling it's building to critical mass, which can have a terrible effect on space-time itself.
As Brigid stared at the spire, she became aware that shifting patterns of light and changing colors on the rings brought pain to her eyes and a corresponding throb in her head.
You have a feeling that it's generating the so-called protoplanet force used by the Archons?
Taking her by the elbow, he guided her around the spire.
It's a little more than that. In general relativity and related theories, the distribution of the mass, momentum, and stress due to matter interacting with a non-gravitational field is called an energy-momentum tensor. Are you familiar with the term?
Only insofar as the Einstein field equation is applied to it. I do know that his equation isn't very specific about what types of matter or energy fields are admissible in a space-time model.
Breach gave her a fleeting, appreciative smile.
Erica was right. You are far more intelligent than most people in this day and age. All right. I believe the energy conditions within the generator and the transmitter are channeling properties that represent all states of matter and all energy states. Eigenvalues and eigenvectors are unrestricted, and they are imposed at the level of tangent space.
And that means what exactly?
Well, if I knew what it meant exactly, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. But my theory is that enough power is already concentrated in the transmitter to warp the fabric of space-time all over the planet.
The power has to be drawn from somewhere other than the generator.
I agree. I think it's drawn from subspace, and its nature is being modified and focused by the Theta Pinch transmitter.
Focused into what?
Breach paused, mid-step, and turned his stricken face toward her.
That's why we're talking, Brigid. You're the one with experience with this kind of technology.
No one really has experience with it. But I'll do what I can to help you if my hands are freed and you take me to my friends.
All right. You're a hands-on type of scientist, so you need your hands.
Reaching into a pocket of his coverall, he pulled out a small knife and slashed through the nylon straps around Bridget's wrists. She brought her arms around in front of her, flexing her fingers and massaging circulation back into her hands. She turned her challenging gaze on Breach.
And my friends?
This way.
Brigid followed him around the spire, then rocked to a clumsy halt, her stomach lurching. Grant and Kane were bound hand and ankle to a pair of metal frameworks in the shape of X's. Both men were conscious, but they did not look well. Their eyes bore glassy sheens, and their faces glistened with perspiration. Two men wearing the consortium coveralls stood on either side of the frameworks. They looked distinctly unhealthy, their complexions waxy, their eyes surrounded by dark rings. Brigid made a move to lunge toward Kane and Grant, but Breach latched onto her right arm and pulled her back. She pulled out of his grip, but didn't move forward.
They're all right. They haven't been harmed.
Then why are they bound?
Mainly so they won't cause trouble until...
Until what?
Until they can serve as vessels for the vent discharge.
Brigid whirled around and watched Varnley approach, tapping the tip of his infrasound wand against the palm of one hand. Although his high-planed face revealed no emotion, she suddenly knew the hybrid had betrayed them. Struggling to tamp down the surge of fear, Brigid turned to face the traitor.
What's going on here, Varnley?
Should you tell her, Quintus, or shall I?
So you're the real brains of this operation.
Varnley's thin lips creased in an imitation of a smug smile.
Rather more colloquial than I might phrase it, but yes, I've been working with Quintus Breach and his disaffected consortium agents.
Why? You helped him to murder your own people here?
Of course. It was my idea to get rid of the competition.
Competition for what?
What do you think? He's the latest entrant in the ongoing Tomorrow the World sweepstakes, with absolute power as the prize.
And it's corrupted absolutely again.
Brigid glared first at Varnley, then at Breach. Varnley waved the infrasound wand diffidently.
Don't be so melodramatic. I learned about the Theta Pinch transmitter many years ago. It was always my ambition to use it to further the baronial agenda.
The barons are gone.
But their agenda remains.
Which is what?
To unify humanity and the world.
We've heard that one before. Just about everybody who said it to us is dead, including your barons.
Of that, I have no doubt. But with this machine, I can force that unity myself. All it takes is a bit of transformation.
Brigid suddenly understood, and she felt sick.
By turning humanity into a viral form of life? Into ghost walkers?
That phenomenon is a side effect of the Theta radiation. It's not what it was designed to do.
Even so, humanity is already primitive, driven by a kind of herd instinct, living and reproducing in groups. Why not reduce all of that to its most base components?
The Barons are no more. You've become the puppet of a lost and dead conspiracy.
Bridget glared at the hybrid, but Varnley merely regarded her with a mocking smile.
Think you so? Isn't it axiomatic of conspiracies that someone or something else always pulls the strings?
Of ignorant puppets, yes.
I am not that, I can assure you. The puppet masters of this world have always been the Archons.
You're in over your head, Varnley. It's the Anunnaki.
The hybrid finally deigned to glance at Kane.
Do you think you've been able to rip away the cloak of secrecy that has been maintained for over 20,000 years? Hardly. You were tricked by another diversion, one concocted by the Barons.
Bridget stared at Varnley. Although the Cerberus warriors had encountered mentally unstable hybrids in the past, such as Baron Sharp, it hadn't occurred to her that they also might fall prey to simple denial.
We've had this discussion before. You're deluding yourself. The baronies have fallen, the Vils overwhelmed by chaos. The baronial agenda failed. Get used to it.
Without altering his expression of detachment, Varnley slashed Breach viciously across the right cheek with the point of the infrasound wand. The man staggered back, clutching at his face. Fortunately, the device wasn't powered up. If it had been, Breach's facial bones would have shattered like spun crystal.
I suggest you get used to it. You helped me reach this point in the plan, but that doesn't mean I'll tolerate disrespect from humans.
And the next stage of human development is what? Reducing us to single-celled organisms? No, not even that. Just a collection of electrical impulses and ionized gas?
Yes. Not everyone, obviously. We new humans will still need servants.
Slaves.
The energy contained in the transmitter's capacitors needs to be bled off at regular intervals. When exposed to undiluted discharge of the energy, it transforms organic matter into the viral.
That's what happened to most of my staff. The men who chased you in the tunnel had refused to cooperate. They weren't so much trying to kill you as kill Varnley. I wish they'd succeeded.
If they had, then Erica Van Sloan would have no doubt died as well. However, Bridget Baptiste, the sacrifice of your friends may not be necessary.
Why not?
With your help, we may be able to turn off the transmitter, or at least reduce its power needs.
I thought you wanted to turn everyone into ghost walkers.
That was not the original plan, believe me.
What is the plan, then?
Grant lifted his head to glare at Breach. The man standing on his right slammed him back against the framework with a hand pressed against his forehead. Breach's shoulders slumped.
Erica told me about the Theta Pinch experiments in New Mexico. I went to Phantom Mesa Station to claim the technology that still existed. When I activated it, the transmitter... you saw the video record, right?
Your people were turned into ghost walkers, and you were changed too.
He nodded and raised his hands, palm outwards. The skin was black, crusted, and flaking away.
Yes, but because I didn't get a direct jolt, the changeover has been progressive with me. I'm turning into a ghost walker, but by degrees. I've been able to delay the process by venting the radiation that is transforming my cellular structure. When I found out stage 2 of the experiments had been moved here to Area 51, Erica secretly provided me with the gateway coordinates.
What does she plan to do with the transmitter?
Erica described it as a self-sustaining source of free, transmittable energy. Photovoltaic technology, she called it. She said a man named Tesla invented it. She said that if we controlled the energy, then we would control the world.
Why am I not surprised?
Breach dropped his hands and squared his shoulders.
We're as qualified to lay down a foundation for a new society as the goddamn Millennial Consortium. If they have their way, we'll all be a bunch of laborers.
Bridget cast a glance toward Varnley.
That's the underpinnings of the baronial philosophy, so I can see why you two got along, at first.
None of that matters now. We don't control the power here. The generator and the pieces of equipment to channel the protoplanet force are building up to a critical mass. We're talking global decimation.
A rush of sympathy rose in Bridget as she looked into Breach's beseeching gaze.
Let Kane and Grant go free, and I'll stay here to help you figure out how to power down the generator.
No. Bleeding off the energy keeps the reactor within the generator at a manageable level.
We're only buying time that way. The intervals between the venting have become shorter and shorter. The color of the viral has changed from green to red. Now that means something. We're all dying here anyway. We don't have to take the planet with us.
Uncertainty flickered in Varnley's eyes.
I have a counter-proposal. Baptiste stays here, and her friends become part of the viral collective.
Bridget turned to see a man in a consortium coverall slowly trudging down the steps.
Lennox, did you find any trace of the Van Sloan woman?
The man addressed as Lennox shook his head, his face a doleful mask of exhaustion.
No, but I found a trace of Lennox.
Everyone watched in surprised silence as Erica strode down the stairs with the barrel of the Coleco subgun trained on Lennox's back. His face glowing with relief, Breach rushed toward the woman, arms outspread.
Erica, thank God!
She snapped up the Coleco, aiming it right at Breach's head.
That's far enough, Quintus. Don't make me shoot you.
He stumbled to a clumsy halt, lowering his arms, his face twisting in confusion.
What are you... I don't understand. Tell me...
You're probably radioactive, and you look and smell like shit.
Ain't love grand.
Shut up, Baptiste.
Erica pushed Lennox away from her.
I'm the only chance you, Kane, and Grant have of getting out of here alive.
Varnley sidled around Bridget, lifting the infrasound wand, but not activating it.
How are you able to escape the viral?
Erica's lips quirked in a superior smile.
The EMP emitted by the virals affect the brain. Mine isn't quite like everyone else's. Or yours, for that matter.
What do you mean?
The squid implants, right?
Exactly. I maintained consciousness long enough to get out of the viral's effect radius and lay low.
Until now, you were eavesdropping.
Just long enough to form an idea of what's going on here. Quintus, darling, I'm afraid you're screwed.
The air in the room suddenly became hot. The switches stopped their steady clicking.
The final countdown has begun. Venting won't stop the reactor from reaching critical mass now, so you might as well release Kane and Grant and say your goodbyes.
Bridget saw Breach's face go from fear to complete horror. He clutched at himself.
Something is happening inside of me.
It's the protoplanic force, Quintus. It works by mass-to-energy conversion, the ultimate expression of fusion power.
Breach doubled up. Bridget reached out for him, touching him. Heat blazed through her hands, even through the fabric of her gloves. She recoiled.
Ah! The Viral and the Ghostwalkers are intermediate stages of the protoplanic event. Depending on the length and intensity of exposure, the victims can be converted immediately to the viral, or it can take a while, as it has with you. The lifespan of both forms is only a few days.
Foam flecked Breach's writhing lips as he held up hands that started to glow a sickly green. He turned a desperate eye toward Erica.
You knew this?
I guessed. I hoped I was wrong. What the Archons called protoplanic force is really fusion nucleosynthesis, ramped up to the ultimate degree. I'm sorry, Quintus. I really am. But you were dead when you were first exposed in the Phantom Mesa station.
Breach lifted his hands before his face. Pale light pulsed from the palms.
Kill me!
Varnley stepped forward, thumbing the power switch of his infrasound wand. He pointed the tip at Breach's head.
This will be painful, but only for a second.
Don't! It won't make a difference.
Varnley whipped the pulsing wand toward her.
Will it make a difference if I kill you?
Varnley slammed the infrasound rod against the Coleco. Erica staggered backward, the weapon flying from her hands to the ground. Bridget drove an elbow into Varnley's midsection and he folded over. Grasping his arm with both hands, she snapped his elbow against the point of her knee. Bridget snatched the wand from his fingers and whirled around toward Kane and Grant. The Millennialists moved away from the framework to intercept her. Bridget fanned the air with the gleaming wand, thumbing the power output to full. Several pops concussed the air, and the deflected bullets ricocheted in all directions. Both men turned and ran around the base of the spire. Running to Kane and Grant, Bridget touched the vibration-blurred tip of the wand to the slender chains hooked to their manacles. The links fragmented instantly. The two men jumped off the frameworks and glanced around. They saw their weapons resting on a small table behind them. As they retrieved them, Varnley, cradling his broken elbow, stumbled against Breach. The man instinctively touched him, laying his hands flat against Varnley. A torrent of incandescence engulfed the hybrid's body. He burst into flame, transformed into a fire-wreathed scarecrow. His body exploded from within.
Oh my God!
I can't control the reaction going on within me, but I might be able to absorb more of the energy and balance it all out.
Whirling, he staggered toward the base of the transmitter. He slapped both hands onto one of the Alice rings of metal encircling it. The light shimmering from his hands blended with the colors wavering from the rings. An incandescent cocoon settled around him. White flame exploded from the spire. Bursts of light blazed up and down the shaft. Thick, spark-shot smoke plumed out, billows of roiling vapor all but blinding them.
Let's get the hell out of here.
I don't know if running will do any good. If the transmitter starts discharging, no place will be far enough away.
Let's take our chances.
As they came around the transmitter, the Millennialists ran from the opposite direction, Kaliko's blazing. Kane triggered his Sin Eater, and bullets pounded through a dun-colored torso. The man went down, blood spurting from three holes neatly grouped over his heart. The cloud of smoke dimmed the lights, but Grant dropped his pistol sights over the other Millennialist and depressed the trigger stud. The bullet slammed through the man's forehead, punching him backward with such force his head struck the floor first. Great whirls of color danced around the metal rings, growing in size and brilliance. The Cerberus warriors joined Erica at the base of the staircase. She stared, transfixed, her one eye reflecting the shifting colors like a kaleidoscope. A halo surrounded Quintus Breach's body. As they watched, the halo inexorably expanded like ripples in a pond. The edges of the ripples curled in upon themselves and then broke apart, turning into millions of glittering orbs. They were all of different colors, ranging across the visible spectrum.
He's become viral.
Great. Time for us to go before he expects us to join the club.
They turned toward the staircase, but froze when they saw multicolored specks of light flickering over the steps. A swift glance told Brigid there were thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of the orbs. They darted toward the transmitter like a monstrous swarm of bees drawn to a hive.
It's all the surviving virals. Quintus is calling them, summoning them.
Why?
All of them stared unblinkingly as the viral swarm blended together into one giant cloud. One group overlapped with another, changing form, twisting into a helix pattern, then a monstrous ball, and finally into a crisscross of streets shooting back and forth.
Quintus is absorbing them into his matrix. He's smothering the chain reaction.
By degrees, the viral swarm oozed into the rings surrounding the transmitter shaft. The entire structure became shot through with tiny lightning strokes of dazzling light.
They're entering the Alice, becoming inert particles.
Is that good? It's better than the alternative.
The entire viral cloud faded, becoming a faint, feathery mist. Brigid, Kane, Grant, and Erica Van Sloan stood rooted to the spot at the foot of the spiral staircase. They looked for some sign of movement, a fleeting, flitting glimpse of an orb, but they saw nothing around the base of the transmitter.
Is that it?
Things don't always have to end with an explosion, even though that's sometimes more satisfying.
This was all an accident, really. The same kind of accident that destroyed my world 2 centuries ago. Humans playing with the power universe and getting their fingers burned. Another lost dream.
Now you get judgmental. If it had all worked out in your favor, you'd claim it was your destiny or some crap like that.
Brigid turned and headed back up the staircase. After a moment, Erica Van Sloan and Grant followed her. Kane, bringing up the rear, paused long enough to look at the spire of the transmitter.
That thing marks a whole graveyard of buried ambitions and lost dreams.
I'm tired of arguing. Let's get out of here.
Outlander's Ghost Walk is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2008, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Thomas Penny, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Karen Carbone, Eric Messner, Scott McCormick, Tim Getman, Ken Jackson, Elizabeth Demery, and Mort Shelby. additional red shirts by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Chris Rowan. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton and Chris Rowan. Adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. Additional original music by Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, and Brian Patton. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deaflands, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The demon dactyl came awake. It didn't seem such a momentous thing, just a gradual stirring in a deep cave in a far, empty mountain. An unnoticed event, seen by none save the caveworms and those few insomniacs among the bevy of weary bats hanging from the high ceiling. But the demon spirit had awakened, had come back from its long dormancy into the statue-like form it had left behind after its last visit to the world called Corona. The tangible, corporeal body felt good to the wandering spirit. The dactyl could feel its blood, hot blood, coursing through its wings and mighty legs, could feel the twitching of its mighty muscles. Its eyes flickered open, but saw only blackness, for the form, left standing in magical stasis in the deep cave, head bowed and wings wrapped tightly about its torso, had been covered by magma. Most of the fiery stuff of that time long past had bubbled and flowed away from the cavern, but enough had remained to harden about the dactyl's corporeal form. The spirit had come back to Corona, encased in obsidian. The demon's spirit felt deep within itself, summoned its powers, both physical and magical. By sheer will and brute strength, the dactyl flexed its wings. A thin crack ran down the center of the obsidian sarcophagus. The dactyl flexed again. It stretched its great wings out to the side, clawed tips grasping and rending the air. The dactyl threw back its head and opened wide its mouth. It voiced the sheer joy of its return, the anticipation of the chaos it would bring again to the quiet human kingdoms of Corona. Its torso resembled that of a tall, slender man, shaped and lined by corded strands of taut muscle and sporting a pair of tremendous bat-like wings, 20 feet across when fully extended, and with strength enough to lift a full-grown bull in swift flight. Its head, too, was somewhat human, except more angular, with a narrow jaw and pointed chin. The dactyl's ears were pointed as well, poking up about the demon creature's thin tuft of black hair. Neither did that hair hide the creature's horns, thumb-sized and curling in toward each other at the top of the demon's brow. The texture of its skin was rough and thick, an armored hide, reddish in hue and shiny, as if lit by its own inner glow. Shining, too, were the demon's eyes, pools of liquid black at most times, but shifting to fiery red orbs, living flames when the demon was agitated, a glow of absolute hatred. The creature flexed and stretched, extended its wings to their full glory, reached and clawed at the air with its human-like arms. The demon extended its fingernails, transformed them into hooked claws, and grew its teeth, two pointed canines extending down over its bottom lip. Every part of the demon was a weapon, devastating and deadly. And yet, this demon's real strength lay in its mind and its purpose, the tempter of souls, the twister of hearts. the maker of lies.
How long has it been? How many decades, centuries have passed since my last visit to Corona?
The creature remembered that long ago time now, savored the thoughts of the streaming blood as army after army had joined in delicious, desperate battle.
Selling them back to Nomeon.
He saw again the elf who had rallied the humans and the other elves, Terranin Denonial, who chased the Dactyl's armies back to the base of the mountain, Ida. Denonial himself had come into this cave after the beast, had skewered the Dactyl. Yet even in its death throes, the Dactyl had won the day, using its willpower to bring up the magma from the bowels of Ida. Denonio and much of his army had been consumed and destroyed.
I am eternal. I have returned. My physical wounds healed. What man, what elf will take Denonio's place?
Its thoughts turned from its enemies to those it would summon as minions. What creatures could the Dactyl gather this time to wage its war?
The goblins, certainly, full of anger and greed, delighting in murder and war. The Formorian giants of the mountains, few in number, but each with the strength of a dozen men, and a hide too thick and tough for a dagger to puncture. And the Powries, yes, the Powries. The cunning, warlike dwarves of the Julianthes, the Weathered Isles, who hate the humans above all others.
A line of drool hung low from the Dactyl's mouth as it considered its former and future allies, its army of woe.
I will bring them into my fold. Tribe by tribe, race by race, growing as the night grows when the sun touches the western horizon. Hear me, Corona. Your twilight is at hand. I am awake!
Graphic Audio proudly presents R.A. Salvatore's epic saga, The Demon Wars, coming soon.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.